Ephesians chapter 3, verse 14 to chapter 4, verse 3, the 10th talk in a series on Ephesians, was presented by Jack Crabtree on June 10, 2018, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Jack Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to Jack Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. Handout number 8, translation, installment 6, accompanies this talk.
All right, we're going to continue on in Ephesians, the letter to the Ephesians. We didn't quite get through the second section in the introductory part where Paul is talking about his own role and his own ministry and his own place in this project that God has, this agenda that God has for created reality. He described what his role is, and basically it boiled down to two things. It was to proclaim the gospel of Jesus to the Gentiles, make sure that they got the word. But secondly, it was the mystery was revealed to him. And unlike many commentators, I would take the mystery to be primarily centered in the fact that the Messiah would come and die. That was the secret. That was the secret that had been hidden from past ages and generations. And Paul, who was on both sides of that issue, he rejected the Messiah because the Messiah had died, only to then do a complete about-face and turnaround when the Jesus appeared to him alive. And that sent Paul on a journey to figure out, how is it that we missed that? How is it that that it could be true that the Messiah would be crucified by the Romans? What's with that? And he went back to the scriptures and learned what he could. And much of what we have in the New Testament today is the result of Paul having figured out what role the death of Jesus, what significance the death of Jesus had for all of us. Well, Paul identifies that as part of the grace that was given to him, part of the ministry that was delegated to him. Okay, he ends this section, and that's what we'll look at today, with a prayer. So starting with paragraph 15 in my translation, that would be 3:14 and following. Paragraph 15, part 7. For this reason I bow my knees before the Father, by whom every people group under the skies and upon the land is given its name, asking that in accord with the inexhaustible abundance of his glory, he would grant you to be strengthened by his Spirit with power in your innermost self, so that through belief the Messiah would dwell in your hearts. That being rooted in and founded upon his love, you might be able to obtain with all the sanctified ones what is its width and length and height and depth, even that you might come to know the love that is beyond knowing, the love of the Messiah, and that you might be filled within the all, the pleroma of God. Now, with respect to him who is able to do far beyond all that we ask or imagine, in keeping with the miracle being worked in us, may praise be to him for the ecclesia and for Messiah Jesus throughout all the generations, through the final age of ages. Amen. Okay, I'm not exactly sure why he includes this prayer here. It's evident, it's quite clear that it's revealing his passion for the people that God had given him to minister to, for these Gentiles in Asia in particular. He has a real desire, a passionate desire, that they come to believe the truth and be granted the blessing that of eternal life because of believing the truth. So we clearly see his passion. Why does he record that here? I'm not sure I know altogether. So I don't have a good answer to that question. But I'm glad he did. This is a very, very interesting and helpful and instructive prayer. He begins by saying, I bow my knees before the Father, by whom every people group under the skies and upon the land is given its name. I've always looked at that as kind of a throwaway in the past. Anytime I'd read over it, it just sounds like more pious talk, more pious speech. But when you pause to think about what he's saying, this is a pretty profound point that he's making. For this reason, I bow my knees before the Father. Who is the Father? He's the one by whom every people group under the skies and upon the land is given its name. Now, what exactly does he mean by is given its name? To name someone, the name of someone, I think in Jewish culture in particular, but even in our culture to some extent, to name someone is not just to talk about the label that is placed on those people. To name someone is to identify a particular individual. In this case, it's people groups, but let's just stay with an individual for a second. It's to name an individual who is at the center of a story, of a narrative, and that the narrative that gets played out is what defines who that particular individual is. When in Western philosophy, back in the time about around the time of the Enlightenment, and really even before, there was a problem that developed in philosophy called the problem of identity, the problem of individual identity. What makes a particular human being a particular human being, and that particular human being? I don't remember if it was the English philosopher John Locke or the Scottish philosopher David Hume, but it was, or maybe both, but one or the other, or both of them, they pose a thought experiment. If you took an Englishman, an English gentleman, and then you took his memory and his consciousness and his inner life and inner reality and placed it in the body of a Chinese man, would it still be the same man? That's the question that they pose. Would that still be the same man? And philosophers went back and forth puzzling over that, trying to figure it out. I mean, you see what the issue is. Are we primarily identified by our body, or are we primarily identified by our soul, our inner life, our memory, things like that? And the problem is it's kind of both, right? So since it's kind of both, what if you start playing with that? Then what is the identity of a person really? And it seems to me that the biblical worldview is the only worldview that really has an adequate answer to that question. That individual identity is really not identified by me, it's identified by the story that I am the main character in. My story brings me into interaction with all kinds of people, all kinds of things, all kinds of events, all kinds of circumstances. All of those make me who I am. If I didn't play out the role that I'm playing out in this story that is me, that is around me, I'd be somebody else. I wouldn't be me. The one Western philosopher who seemed to get it right, I think, was a German philosopher by the name of Leibniz. Leibniz famously asked the question, if Caesar had not crossed the Rubicon, would he have been Caesar? And if you know the story of Caesar, he had a fateful decision to make. If he crossed this river, then it was war with Rome, and you as a Roman general weren't supposed to go to war against Rome. But Caesar made the decision to cross the Rubicon. He won, and he became the next emperor, and so on and so forth. But that was a rather momentous decision that he made. But now, what about the less momentous decisions that we make? If I made different decisions other than the decisions I made, would I be me, or would I be somebody else? Well, I think the answer is I'd be somebody else. ultimately, because I am the character in a story that is being created by the Father, by whom every individual, let alone people group, but by whom every individual under the skies and upon the land is given its name. I am Jack, and all that that entails, and all that that implies, and all that is contained in that, because the Father has created me. And you are whoever you are, you have the name that you have, and all that is entailed by that, because the Father is authoring you, is creating you, is telling your story in real time in this life that we're a part of. Well, what's true of individuals is also true of people groups. There are different people from all over the world, and we can become so chauvinistic that we think none of them count. We are the only ones that count. But from God's perspective, the stories, their history, the history of those family groups, the history of those people groups, is just as much a part of God's multi-textured, multi-colored, much varied, diverse creation as anything else is. It's all part of the Creator God weaving together multiple stories, multiple histories into this incredible tapestry that we call human history. And our history books only capture a fraction of what's actually going down out there, of the stories that are actually being played out. Well, every people group receives its name, is given its name by the author of all of reality, the Father, the one he calls the Father. So for this reason, I bow my knees before the Father, by whom every people group under the skies and upon the land. Most of your English translations are going to have in the heavens and on the earth. What people groups do you know are in the heavens? That doesn't make any sense. Because he's clearly talking about human beings and the family groups, the tribal groups of human beings. That's what he's clearly talking about. So under the skies and upon the land, as I argued earlier in Ephesians, he uses these same two phrases. And I think that they represent the Jews and the Gentiles. The Gentiles are those people groups, those family groups that live on the land. What land? Well, the land of Israel, the only land from a Jewish perspective that counts. They're the people that live on the land, and then there's everybody else. And they live out there on lands under the sky as far as the sky will reach. Those are the Gentiles. That would be us. But there are different groups of Jews and there's different groups of Gentiles, but every last one of them has a name that given to them by the Father. Now remember, foremost in Paul's mind throughout the book of Ephesians is the Jewish-Gentile distinction, because that was the issue in Paul's life, in Paul's experience, in Paul's day. The issue is the relationship between the Jews and the Gentiles. Can Gentiles actually be saved by the Jewish Messiah and still be Gentiles and still look like Gentiles and still live like Gentiles and still act like Gentiles? Or do they have to become Jewish to be saved? And Paul is a champion of the Gentiles being saved by belief in Jesus the Messiah and still remaining Gentiles as they do so. All right, so he bows his knees before this author of all reality, who is the author of every one of our stories, asking that in accord with the inexhaustible abundance of his glory, he would grant you to be strengthened by his Spirit with power in your innermost self, so that through belief, the Messiah would dwell in your hearts. Okay, he has in mind these Gentiles in Asia. That's the you here. What does he mean, in accord with the inexhaustible abundance of his glory? God's glory, of course, is anything that makes you go, wow, in relationship to God. What, as you come to know him, see him, observe him, understand him, we can't help but be impressed by who God is and what he's capable of. Here, I think the glory that he has in mind is probably twofold. It certainly is his power, because he immediately goes on to say that he would grant you to be strengthened by his Spirit with power in your innermost self. So certainly it's his power. But I suspect here that it also includes his mercy, because we have already seen for three chapters how much this is demonstrating the profound depths of God's mercy, that God is doing what he's doing and blessing us in the way that he's blessing us. So I think it includes both his mercy and his power that is in inexhaustible abundance, he says. We often lose sight of the fact we easily lose sight of the inexhaustible abundance of God's mercy. How often do you hear people saying, my sins are just too bad. I am just too awful. God could never forgive me. Well, then we don't know God, because God's mercy is inexhaustible in its abundance. The power that he's talking about, it always seems strange, especially when we look at what he's talking about here, to talk about God's power. When I think about power, I think of physical exertion, and I don't think of creation as being power at work, where, like if in Genesis 1, do you see the power of God? God says, let there be light, and there's light. Let there be light. What kind of power is there? Well, it's the power of creativity. And I think that's the power that is in view here as well. The power of being able to simply will something into existence and it will be in existence. It's not the kind of strength that he has to exert himself. All he has to do is will it to be so, and it will be so. It comes out of God's transcendence. He's not even a part of this world. He's completely other than this world. And all he has to do is will something into being in this world, and it will come into being. Well, from our perspective, that's powerful. That's a kind of power. Well, that's exactly what Paul is asking for. In accord with the inexhaustible abundance of his glory, mercy, and power, he's asking that God would grant you, Ephesian Gentiles, he would grant you to be strengthened by his Spirit with power in your innermost self, so that through belief the Messiah would dwell in your hearts. Okay, why would I need to be strengthened in my innermost self to come to belief? Well, that's a theme that you see woven throughout the New Testament over and over and over again. We have so many forces arrayed against us that would push on us and shape us and mold us and influence us, such that we would never believe the truth of the gospel. We would never believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Primarily it comes, as we saw earlier in Ephesians, that through the power of the air that we live in, our culture. Satan, who is the author of the forces of our culture, has implanted in our culture so many myths, so many lies, so many false attitudes, false perceptions, false desires, false values, that we just drink in with our mother's milk. We're just shaped and created and made by the culture that makes us. And it takes a miracle. How do you unmake a human being who has been created by his culture. How do you do that? Well, you don't, and I don't, and I can't recreate myself. It requires the miracle of the Spirit of God himself invading my inner being and completely rewiring me, remaking me, making me respond to a different set of priorities, a different set of values, a different set of perceptions of reality, so that I am a weirdo in my culture. I am completely at odds with my culture. But how do you get there? It takes the power and strength of God himself working his miracle in my heart, in my inner being. So that's what Paul's praying for. I'm praying out of your mercy and power, your inexhaustible abundance of mercy and power, that he would grant to you to be strengthened by his Spirit with that power, working in your innermost self so that through belief, so that by coming to belief, the Messiah would dwell in your hearts. I think what he means by that is, I mean, we know all kinds of people who have flirted with Jesus, but they've never really taken him in and let him stay there, let him lodge there. It's one thing to kind of entertain the idea of Jesus and all that that is and all that that stands for. It's another thing to make him a permanent resident in your heart. Now, it's not the Sunday school notion of Jesus living in your heart. Jesus never does come and live in my heart. He's a human being, and human beings can't come into my heart. But for the Messiah to dwell in my heart is for my commitment to follow the Messiah to be permanently lodged there, to be a permanent fixture in my inner being. That's what he means by that. Okay, that's the first thing he's asking the Father. The second thing he's asking the Father, he says, being rooted in and founded upon his love, you might be able to obtain with all the sanctified ones what is the width and length and height and depth, even that you might come to know the love that is beyond knowing, the love of the Messiah. Okay, now if you're looking at, don't look at your typical English translation, it will completely confuse you. I'm taking it in an entirely different way. I mean, all the same words are going to be there, but the translators have interpreted it very differently than I have. Being rooted and founded upon his love, that's weird. What do you mean, being rooted and founded upon his love? I think that goes back to, it's an allusion back. How far back does it go? All the way back to 11. I don't think I have that in front of me, but remember in paragraph 11 where he talks about God is causing to be built up a holy temple to himself, something like that. Well, you found a temple. You put it on a foundation, and that's the word that he's using here. You root a plant that grows. So I think what he's has in mind here is the main project of God that he's already outlined. He's going to go and talk about it some more once we get past his prayer. He's going to go back and return to it. God has one agenda for created reality, for human history. What is God's agenda for human history? It's to create this thing. This thing that is a group of people who are going to be the eternal people of God throughout all the ages into the eternal age of ages. And it's that community of people he's culling out from all of the individual human beings on the earth. He's snatching out individuals and placing them into this thing that he's creating. He calls it an ecclesia. He calls it a body. He calls it the pleroma. He calls it the everyone. I mean, he just has all kinds of phrases that he uses to refer to it. On the one hand, it's like a building that he's building. So he calls it a holy temple to God. So on the one hand, it's like a building. On the other hand, in the next chapter, he's going to compare it to an organism. It's like an organism that is increasing in its stature and height as it adds members to it and grows and is mutually supportive of one another so that it grows into this thing that God wants to create, that God wants to produce. Well, I think that's in the back of his mind, and I think that's why he chooses the language here, being rooted in, like a plant, or founded upon, like a building, his love. Okay, what love is he talking about? God's love for us. So where does this community, this thing that God is creating and producing, where does it start from? The love of God that he has demonstrated for us, or that he has enacted toward us. So being rooted in and founded upon his love, his prayer is that they might be able to obtain with all the sanctified ones. We've talked about this before. A sanctified one is another way of describing an individual that God has culled out of humanity, out of the sea of humanity. He's picked out, selected out individuals set apart for this destiny of existing in the people of God for all of eternity and serving him for all of eternity as the people of God. Those are the sanctified ones. So his prayer is that you might obtain with all the sanctified ones what is the width and length and height and depth of... Well, Paul didn't finish the idea, I think, but I think he thinks it's clear enough from the context of God's love for us. What is the width and length and height and depth of it? But what he has in mind is, what is the width and length and height and depth of this blessing that God has in store for us because of his love? I mean, what is it going to be like to be a part of the eternal people of God for all of eternity in a new heavens and a new earth, in a creation where there is no evil, there is no injustice, there is no none of the garbage that makes this life so bittersweet, promising so much and delivering so little by comparison? It ain't going to be that way in the eternal kingdom of God, in the age to come. We are going to be a righteous people, living in righteousness, reflecting the very character, the very love and justice and truth and purity and integrity of God himself in our relationship to one another. Well, what is that going to be like? Well, really, can we even fathom that? Can you even imagine that? I try to imagine life, and I always get this one. With all of its futility and disappointment and frustration and evil and unrighteousness and injustice, because it's so close to me, it's built into me. Can I imagine me being good? Not really. I mean, how can we? But Paul's prayer is that you find out one day. My prayer is that you will find out how absolutely phenomenally glorious this blessing that God, out of in his love, has set apart for the sanctified ones. I want you to be able to experience every breadth, height, length, depth of that glorious destiny and inheritance that he has for you. And then he repeats himself in different language, even that you might come to know the love that is beyond knowing. Now again, what is the love? It's God's love for us. So I'm hoping that you'll come to know the love that is beyond knowing. He doesn't mean have an intellectual comprehension of it. He means the kind of knowledge that comes because I'm experiencing it, because I'm in it. I'm benefiting from that love. So even that you might come to benefit from and therefore know the love that is beyond knowing. Well, we have no clue. It is completely unfathomable. And then he identifies it, if we haven't figured out yet, the love of the Messiah. What is it that the Messiah has bought for us, has purchased for us out of his love? So that's the second thing that he's praying. And then the third thing, and that you might be made full within the all. Now, the third thing is basically, I think, just a restatement of the second one. What does he mean that you might be made full? Well, I think what he means is that you might fully realize all the blessing that God and all the inheritance that God has in store for you. How are you going to do that? By being a member of the all, or the pleroma, usually translated fullness, of God. If I am an individual member of the fullness of God, then I am going to be made full when the day comes to move out of this age into the next age. And then he ends his prayer here in paragraph 16. This is 320. Now, with respect to him who is able to do far beyond all that we ask or imagine, in keeping with the miracle being worked in us, may praise be to him for the ecclesia and for Messiah Jesus throughout all the generations through the final age of ages. Amen. It's just sort of a call to appreciate God for who he is and what he's done, for his creating the ecclesia on the one hand, and for his Messiah Jesus that he sent that makes that all possible. May he be praised throughout all generations for all time because of what he's done. Again, I think it helps us understand that from Paul's perspective, that's the whole point. That is the primary agenda of God in human history, is to create his ecclesia through the work of his Messiah, Jesus. Okay, that's the end of that section. In the next section, we get to the very heart of the work of Ephesians. Before I move on to that, let me pause for any questions or comments you have on what we just covered.
I was gone last week, so if you covered this already, let me know. What's the antecedent for the phrase in verse 14, for this reason? What reason is he talking about?
I take it to be what he's just talked about is the responsibility, the gift that was given to him. He's an apostle to the Gentiles, and what God gave him as a role was to proclaim the gospel to the Gentiles and to make known the secret that had been hidden from past generations. But just in general, I think the reason for this reason is I bear a responsibility to you Gentiles. So I'm going to proclaim the gospel to you, but while I'm at it, let me pray for you.
Okay.
And let me pray this. This is the prayer that I pray for you.
So he's just described his responsibility, and that's the reason why he's...
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
Thank you.
Anything else? You don't want to fight me about anything? Okay. I knew.
In, I guess it's 15, chapter 15, or paragraph 15, part 7, paragraph 15, that being rooted and founded upon his love, you might be able to obtain. We're going to obtain what is the width and length and height and depth.
Mm-hmm.
Even come to know the love that is beyond knowing.
Mm-hmm.
To know the love that is beyond knowing.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have a problem with that?
Yeah. to experience, I mean, he's using know in two different senses, okay, to actually benefit from and experience the love that is beyond imagining ahead of time what it's going to be.
And then New American Standard has that you may be filled up to all the fullness of God.
Yeah.
And you,
it sure does.
You're saying, you can't say that. You're saying the fullness is the pleroma, the set of believers that God is putting together. So linguistically, how did you do that there?
Let me look at the Greek text for a second. 3:19. Okay, that you might be filled up. I'm taking ace there to be literally in... It's to be filled up, but I don't think that would stand alone.
Yeah.
Because in the context, what you'd be filled up with is the inheritance, the blessing, that you would fully enter into the blessing that the love of the Messiah has purchased for you. It's the, you'd be filled up such that you experience the height, the depth, the length, and the width. I mean, that he's just pulling out the stops rhetorically to try to, as many coming at it in three different ways, to try to say, I want you to experience absolutely everything that God has in store for you as one whom he has elected for himself. So the filled up part, I lost the place. Okay, that's all he has to say, I think, in this context for him to say that. And then he has ace pon ta pleroma tu theou. Ta pleroma tu theou, that's the pleroma of God. But what's this pon? Well, I think pleroma tu theou is in apposition to pon. And else earlier, another term that he has used to describe this group of people, Jew and Gentile and people from all over the world throughout all of human history, they are the all, that is, the everyone that God has chosen to that destiny. And one of the words he uses to describe that is the all, or you could translate it everyone if you wanted, but tapon. So I think he's saying that you might be filled up being put into, that's the preposition, the pon, which is the pleroma of God.
Okay, that makes more sense, I think, than what I've heard down through the years, that somehow we either become part of God or we become like God in that we have everything he has. I mean, this makes more sense.
Right. And see, I think, I mean, on the one hand, it's forgivable that Bible teachers and commentators and so on go that direction because they translate it the way they translate it. And now you have to come up with a theology that makes that translation make any sense. So you make junk up. So you just say, well, we're going to, I mean, there are some Christian traditions who literally teach that you become gods. You become godlike. And I'm sure they use that as a proof text. But that's not what Paul's saying. I mean, if we follow the argument of Ephesians, it's quite clear what he's focused on. By when he pleroma is not a word that occurs in the New Testament very often, but it occurs several times here in Ephesians, half a dozen at least here in Ephesians. It's because it's a technical term that he's using in this argument. The only other place that it, well, not the only other place, it gets used once in Hebrews, but that's a whole different meaning. The other place it gets used is Colossians. And if we were studying Colossians, we'd find out that Paul writes Ephesians, then he turns right around and writes Colossians and says the same thing in Colossians that he said in Ephesians to another church in Asia. I mean, the same issues, the same themes, the same ideas. It's basically covering a lot of the same ground in Colossians. So, yes, it occurs also in Colossians, but it means the same thing in Colossians than it means here in Ephesians, because it's all part of the same argument that there is this fullness of God's people, and the fullness of God's people, the pleroma of God's people, includes Jews and Gentiles. Not just Gentiles, not just Jews. You got to have everybody in order for it to be the people of God that God is forming. And we could take that to other times and places and situations in history, and the emphasis would be not on Jew-Gentile, but would be on, look at all the divisions, all the ways we people divide up. Well, from God's perspective, he's taking people from every people group, throughout all of history. The Vikings and the Mongols and that's the full extent of my human history. Taking all kinds of different people, and he's drawing them building them into this people that belong to him and are going to from all of eternity.
So just translating that, it seems to me in the English ear, if you change that from the fullness of God to God's fullness, even that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Because it's something he possesses,
right,
not something he is.
Yeah, exactly. And the Greek is capable of both. I mean, it could mean either of those. But yeah, the question is, which did Paul have in mind? I think it's possession. It's the fullness that belongs to God in this context. Exactly. Okay? Anything else? All right, let's go on then. So now we get to the very heart of his argument. Because remember, I mentioned right at the beginning of this series that really the purpose that is driving him writing Ephesians is to answer the question, how should we live? We are followers of Jesus. We are people who believed in Jesus. Okay, so what? How should we live given that we are followers of Jesus? Well, he's going to begin answering that question now in paragraph 17. Therefore, I urge you, I, the prisoner because of the Lord, to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you have been called, with all lowliness of mind and lack of presumption, with long-suffering, putting up with one another out of love, strive earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit, based on the mutual bond of peace. There is one body and one Spirit, inasmuch as indeed you were called to one hope of your calling. There is one Lord, one belief, one baptism. There is one God and Father of all, he who is over all and to all and for all. Okay, I'll stop there for now. So I urge you to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you have been called. Okay, that's his fundamental answer to the question of how should we live. I mean, if he stopped there, he's said enough. There's a lot that needs to be unpacked from that, but packed into that statement that we should walk in a manner suited to the calling to which we've been called, he's said everything that he's going to say in the rest of the letter. Okay, the word calling is capable of lots of different meanings. Kaleo in Greek is capable of lots of different meanings. It can mean to invite someone. If you call someone, you have invited someone. It can mean literally to shout out to someone, call their name, for example. It can mean to name somebody, to give somebody a name. I call you Joe. It can mean to appoint someone to some role or some office or something that you would appoint someone to. Sometimes it's very difficult to know in what sense Paul, for example, means it. Because what is he identifying? Well, those of us who have been called to be a part of the people of God, the eternal people of God? When did that start? Before the foundation of the earth. Before God had even brought light into existence, God had called, that is, had appointed, particular individuals to have their particular role in this drama that he was about to bring into existence of human history. Well, before he brought it into an existence, he already had in mind who was going to play what role, who was going to be a part of what story, and what was their destiny going to be. Were they going to be a part of the eternal people of God in the final age? Well, he had already determined that. In fact, those who were, he created for that very purpose and to that very end. Just as, obnoxiously so, just as those who were going to destruction, he had created with their destruction in mind. That was going to be their story. Remember Romans 10, the one who created vessels of wrath prepared for destruction and vessels of mercy prepared for glory. God, the potter, is the one who creates both kinds of pots. Incredibly unknown, unaccepted, unreceived doctrine by Christian culture today, but it's clear as day in Paul if we're willing to hear him and listen to him and get inside of his thinking. So before the world even created, God had appointed to belong to the eternal people of God those whom he was going to appoint to that. Then he brought that person into existence. He brought you as one who was appointed to that destiny, brought you into existence. And then somewhere along the line, you heard him inviting you. You heard the invitation to make a decision to choose to believe the truth about Jesus. Well, the New Testament also talks about that as the call of God, the invitation of God, inviting you to that. Well, we've experienced both, that we didn't experience both, but both things are true about us. I was called in the sense of being appointed before the foundation of the earth, but I also am a believer today because I was invited by a kind of irresistible invitation, right? It was the kind of invitation that, damn it, I couldn't refuse. I couldn't not accept it. And I was drawn into this relationship with Jesus that I had been predestined for. But at several junctures, there are places that we could describe it as being called by God. Here, I think it could be either, but I think what he means by the calling to which you have been called is probably best understood as in accordance with the appointment to which you have been appointed. And what he has in mind is, what is this thing to which you have been appointed? Being a part of the people of God, the eternal people of God, the pleroma, the ecclesia, the body, the whatever you want to call it, the holy temple that God is building up to himself made of us. This organism that he's going to talk about in a few paragraphs that is growing up to maturity. What is it? Well, in reverse order, let me look at my notes here. In reverse order, there's basically three aspects of it that he highlights. And he's going to deal with them in the remainder of the book in exactly the reverse order of what I'm going to give to you here. But we are to walk in a manner, if you're going to walk in a manner that's suited to the calling to which you've been called, the appointment to which you've been appointed, then you will walk righteously. Now, why righteously? Well, what is God doing? He's building a monument to himself. If I live unrighteously, I am hardly walking in a manner suited to the purpose for him making me a part of the body or the pleroma or this temple that he's building. Certainly, God is not going to build any body as a monument to himself that is contrary to who he is. God is righteous, so this appointment to which we've been appointed to is going to be a community that is righteous, a body that is righteous. So we must walk righteously. And the most of Ephesians is spent on describing specific ways in which we will walk that is consistent with righteousness. So we will walk righteously. But it's also true that we will understand God's project and seek to contribute to that project. Well, what does it mean? He's going to talk about that shortly in Ephesians, but God has thrown us together to be a part of this group that he's creating, that he's building, and the whole purpose is to create this group. So I need to kind of dig that fact and go out there in the world and do what I can to contribute to that. So, for example, evangelism would be one. Evangelism, rightly understood, would be one of those things. I'm going to recognize that God is looking for those people out there who belong to him and have belonged to him from before the foundation of the earth. Somebody needs to invite them so that they can be joined into this thing that God is doing and become a part of it. So if I recognize that that's what God is doing in the world, why wouldn't I cooperate with that by taking every opportunity I can to invite people to become a part of this? If they're not appointed to it, they're not going to accept the invitation. But if they are appointed to it, they are going to accept the invitation. So no harm in inviting them. And in fact, I should be eager to invite people. People are not going to really be a part of this unless they know and understand and believe and are in it to stay. Because life is going to throw a lot of garbage at them and is going to try to drive them away from Jesus, drive a wedge between them and Jesus. I need to do what I can to help people have the knowledge, the understanding, and the wisdom that will fortify them so that when life comes at them in full force, they're not blown away from belief. Yeah, they won't be driven away. Well, that takes teaching. They need to be taught. They need to understand. That understanding needs to go deep so that they will continue in belief, persevere in belief. That's going to be a way I can contribute to the project. Well, if I understand what God's project is, I'll understand how important it is to be involved in something like that. And then the third thing, and this is the first thing he's going to take up, is we will understand that everybody is on exactly the same basis as every other member of the eternal people of God. There are no first-class citizens and second-class citizens. There is no Jew or Gentile, no male or female, no slave or free, no Scythian, no sophisticated, wise, educated person and uneducated fool. Those are the distinctions that Paul uses at various places in his letters. But any other distinction that you could think of, Paul would gladly say, yeah, there's none of that either. We're all on exactly the same basis. The only thing that makes me a part of the eternal people of God is that I have come to believe in Jesus the Messiah, and I'm willing to sit at his feet and have him teach me. And if I'm a disciple of Jesus in that way, then I'm part of that people. And anyone and everyone who is in that relationship with Jesus is in exactly the same place that I am. I am no better than they are, and they are no better than I am. We're in exactly the same place. So that's the first thing he's going to pick up. Implicit in what he's saying here, I think, I got a, you know, Roger Ruddle used to live here and would come up and lead singing. He wrote a paper called On Being in Christ that he sent to me, and I'm gonna see if we can make that available to you somehow, I don't know, through the mailing list or something. But very, very interesting, very insightful paper. And one of the points he makes is being in Christ should be the number one defining fact about me. And I think that's implicit in what Paul is saying here. If I'm going to walk in a manner suitable to the calling to which I've been called, one of the implications of the calling to which I've been called is there is nothing more important about me and what makes me me beyond my being in Christ, my being a follower of Jesus. My maleness, my whiteness, my Americanness, my whatever else there is. I don't have a lot of self-knowledge. I can't make a list. Whatever it is that makes me me, the most important thing is that I'm a follower of Jesus. Nothing else should hold a candle to that. And everything else will fade in importance to that. I'll try to get that paper to you because I think it's very, very helpful, very interesting. So that's what he's going to unpack in the rest of the letter are basically those three things. First, the oneness of the people, in the people of God, implies that we need to preserve the oneness. He will first say, so preserve the oneness that we have. Secondly, he's going to encourage us to recognize what role we have in the body and to play out that role. But then most importantly and thirdly, to walk in a manner suitable to the calling is to walk righteously, for our God is a righteous God. Why does Paul identify himself here as the prisoner because of the Lord? As we've said, he's in prison in Rome, and why is he in prison in Rome? Because he's been shooting off his mouth about Jesus in the Roman Empire, and he's got himself in trouble, and he's managed to get himself arrested, and he's in house arrest in Rome. Well, why does he mention that here? I think it's because it's basically his way of saying, I've put my money where my mouth is. I have done everything I can to walk in a manner worthy of the calling to which I've been called, and I'm inviting you to imitate me and do likewise. Okay, so let's look at the first thing. Therefore, I urge you, I, the prisoner because of the Lord, to walk in a manner suited to the calling to which you've been called, with all lowliness of mind and lack of presumption, with long-suffering, putting up with one another out of love, strive earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit based on the mutual bond of peace. Okay, a lot of phrases in there. What's the heart of it? What's this simple sentence in there? Strive earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit. Now, he's going to go on to talk about what that oneness is. Let me keep reading. There is one body and one Spirit, inasmuch as indeed you were called to one hope of your calling. There is one Lord, one belief, one baptism. There is one God and Father of all, so on. That's the oneness that he's talking about. He's not talking about... a lot of your English translations translate it unity. And any time I ever heard anyone teach from this, what they would emphasize is how important it is that in our church we have unity. Paul is exhorting us to have unity. And basically, exhorting the church to have unity is saying, if you don't like the way I'm running the church, leave. Because we need unity here. Something along those lines. That's not what Paul's talking about. He's not really even talking about interrelational unity. I mean, he is, but this unity is not something that we create. This unity is from the Spirit, he says. This unity is something created by the Spirit of God himself. Now, how? If... if you and I belong to this same body, it's because the Spirit of God has come into our lives and branded us on the inside. He's taken a branding iron to my heart and claimed ownership of who I am. And what does it mean to take a branding iron to my heart? He's done that miracle in me where he is beginning to give me different desires, different priorities, different passions, different perceptions. We've talked about this before. It's what the Bible calls holiness. It's my sanctification. He's making me march to the beat of a different drum from everybody else around me in my culture. And that's the mark, the brand of God's ownership on me. I know I belong to this body because my heart is different, is radically different from the heart of human beings in general. Okay, well, so it's the Spirit that has placed me in this body by branding me in that way. Well, in doing so, he's made me at one with everyone else that he's put in that body. And it doesn't matter what cultural differences might divide me from that other person, or what ethnic differences might divide me from that other person. Those are irrelevant, because we are in the same eternal body that God is creating because we've been put there by the Spirit of God. And if I don't like who he put me together with to be one with, then you need to take it up with God. Because he's not asking me. He's the one who has chosen to put us together and make us one in the one and the same body. So his exhortation is, there's two ways I can respond to that oneness that the Spirit of God created, not me. I can respect it, or I can disrespect it. If I respect the oneness that God has created, then I'm going to work to not allow cultural, ethnic, other differences between people, personality differences, I'm not going to allow those to rise in importance and get in the way of me knowing, understanding, and respecting we are in the same status. You and I are brothers and sisters in this family, the people of God. If we allow those other differences to loom too large, then we are disrespecting the oneness that the Spirit of God has created. So his first exhortation is, given that we have been called to the calling to which we have been called, given that, we need to strive to preserve or respect this oneness that has been created by the Spirit of God. What's the basis for this oneness? Based on the mutual bond of peace. Well, he spent a whole paragraph on that earlier in Ephesians. What's this mutual bond of peace? It's the mutual bond between us that comes because God established peace between you and God the same way he established peace between me and God through the blood of Jesus. And because he established peace with God for you the same way he established it with me, we are bonded by that. We are made the same by that. All right, so striving earnestly to preserve the oneness which is from the Spirit, how do we go about doing that? Well, he began the sentence with that. With what are some of the ways that we do that? All lowliness of mind and lack of presumption, with long suffering, putting up with one another out of love. Now, think back in the context in which he's writing. Paul knows all too well from personal experience as a Jew the self-righteousness, the pride, the presumption that he would have felt as a Jew. Gentiles were Gentile dogs to the Jews. So Paul knows very well that if you're going to preserve the oneness that's been created by the Spirit of God, you're going to have to get over yourself. You're going to have to not think more highly of yourself than you ought to, which you are going to be tempted to do. You're going to have to not be presumptuous, not think that you're entitled because you're a Jew. I mean, don't get me wrong, the Gentiles had their own version of that as well. Some Gentiles, I mean, clearly the Romans looked down on the Jews. They thought they were ridiculous. But it goes both ways. But don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to think. Don't be presumptuous. That is, don't cop an attitude of entitlement. I'm owed what I'm owed because I am me. And then put up with one another out of love, with long suffering. Put up with one another out of love. We all know that ethnic groups are distinctly different because they have different ways of living life, different ways of relating to each other, different ways of thinking about their circumstances and so on. And in our innate chauvinism, we have a tendency to think, my way of doing things is the right way and the best way and the good way to do things. Their way of doing things is disgusting, ridiculous, whatever. And we get annoyed, right? We get annoyed with people who are different than we are. And it doesn't have to be ethnic differences. I mean, your own family drives you crazy. I mean, just personality differences do as well. That those differences grate on you, and the tendency is for them to annoy you and irritate you, and, you know, you just stop it. Would you just be different, you know? And he's saying, with long suffering, put up with one another. Recognize that I am me, and you are you, and you ain't me, and that's why you do things differently and think about things differently. And I think at that point there's a choice that we make. We can either choose to appreciate the differences in the among human beings in this life and kind of look at them with some kind of wonderment, or we can decide to disrespect the other person. They're not making me disrespect them. That's on me. I'm choosing to disrespect them. They're just being themselves. They're just being who they are. And I have a choice to make that I will either respect who they are or I will disrespect who they are. And what Paul is encouraging us to do is, we've been thrown in this thing together for all of eternity. We've been thrown into this thing together. We need to respect the oneness that the Spirit of God has created, and out of that, learn to act toward one another in a way that's commodious, that creates some kind of harmony and welcoming friendliness instead of strife, turmoil, and irritation, annoyance all the time. Okay, questions or comments on this so far? We're about out of time, so.
Hey, Jack. It's kind of striking that his prescription for preserving oneness between all these different people groups is interpersonal, mm-hmm. and isn't on the level of social action or, you know, tearing down barriers between peoples or classes or changing the way that your culture does things, et cetera, et cetera. So could you talk about that at all?
Yeah, that's true throughout the New Testament. It is so striking, both in Jesus and in Paul and all the apostles. Their emphasis is always on me, on what am I doing? How am I behaving? How am I interacting? on the one hand, was there a utopia that was going to be built and was going to come into existence? Yes, there was, and they looked forward to that. But that was when Jesus was reigning as king. Then it was going to be a kind of the closest thing that history would ever know to a utopia is going to happen when Jesus is reigning over Israel as king. The rest of history, the rest of our political structures, the rest of our institutions are riddled with human evil. They will always be oppressive and unjust and unfair and all the stuff that comes down because of human evil that just gets built into the institutions that we build or the organizations that we build. And you never, ever, you have an acknowledgement of that, I think, in a way. Later in Ephesians, he's going to talk about strongholds, which when we get there, I mean, we might see that has some implications, cultural strongholds for certain kinds of evil. But even then, his point is that we need to be able to keep the faith in the face of those strongholds and not allow them to drive us away from the faith. And that's always his emphasis. Are you going to keep the faith and are you going to pursue righteousness? But the whole idea of reforming a culture, it was never Jesus' agenda. It was never Paul's agenda. They never encouraged us to make it our agenda. I just need to worry about me. And what's interesting is, I mean, I think it's probably the case, did God in history ever call individuals to a particular role that involved some kind of social reform? What's the guy's name in England? Wilberforce. And I think so, but it's interesting as we're going to look at the things that he says that God appointed. Social reformers is never on the list. Doesn't mean that God doesn't do that, but it's not at the forefront of Paul's mind, most certainly. Anything else? Okay. We'll pick it up here next week.